I'm Steve Stein, and welcome to another episode of Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. Thanks for listening. This week, my guest is... Okay, let's give that another shot. I'm Steve Stein, and welcome to another episode of... Hello?
Dad, it's Becca.
Bex, it's my daughter, Becca. Is everything all right?
Sort of.
Sort of?
Everything is not all right.
What is it?
The environment.
The environment?
You probably don't care.
Of course I care. It's just that I'm in the middle of taping an episode.
I know.
You know?
That's why I'm calling.
You're calling because I'm taping an episode?
I'm worried about the environment. Climate change.
Can't this wait?
I don't think so. Seriously. You know how you always give me the World Economic Forum Global Risk Report for a Christmas present? Well, I read it this year.
You read it?
The news is not good. Did you know that this is the first time in the history of the World Economic Forum that concerns about global climate change, environment, and natural disasters outweighed political and economic risk as the leading concerns among global leaders?
That sounds bad.
Did you even read it? How come you aren't doing episodes on the environment? It's only the world's most important issue. Seriously, Dad.
You know what? We will.
You will?
You know, you're right.
Promise?
Yep. We're going to dedicate the next month of episodes to environmental issues as they relate to doing business in Asia, starting now.
I'm holding you to it. I'll be listening.
That was my daughter, Becca, and that was our way of announcing that here at Inside Asia, we're kicking off a month of episodes devoted to environmental issues and their impact on business and economics. We start off with Peter Kennedy, who leads CLSA's Clean Resources Private Equity Fund based here in Singapore. When you hear the term private equity, it may conjure up images of corporate raiders and Wall Street moguls. But Peter's a different kind of investor. He's an impact investor. His Clean Resources Fund targets growth stage investments in renewable energy, purification technologies, and sustainable agriculture. This is no charity. Peter and his colleagues are in the business to make money, but with the added advantage of making the world a better place. He's in the throes of raising a new fund, this time entirely focused on water. And yes, that's the sound that pops into most minds when we think of water. There's a lot of it, right? Wrong. The reality sounds more like this. Water scarcity is a real thing. Don't believe me? Have you read recently about Cape Town in South Africa? This spectacularly beautiful city with a population of nearly 4 million people is on the verge of running dry. Authorities point ominously to day zero, a time in early May or June when the city will have no choice but to shut off water supplies and establish water collection points to preserve what water they have left. Dozens of other metropolitan cities around the world face a similar fate. Sao Paulo, Bangalore, Beijing, Cairo, Jakarta are just a few heavily populated cities that are now contemplating life with little or no water. Water scarcity and what we can do about it is a topic of this episode. I start by asking Peter how worried we need to be. Like climate change, is water security seen as more of a distant notion or an immediate crisis?
I think this is a more of a global problem, and there's a really acute issues here in Asia as well. You know, as we discussed earlier, you know, Cape Town was a fairly sustainable city. They actually were conserving water and putting a lot of processes in place, but they didn't diversify. And now they're hit with, you know, one of the other areas that's really causing the supply demand imbalance is some of the big climate movements and impacts that are out there. But if we look around in places like China, you know, China basically has 20% of the population, 7% of the water. But if you look at geographically, specifically, the breadbasket is up north, which has 65% of the arable land, and it only has 20% of the water.
So they've been rerouting water from the south to the north for decades now.
No. Well, one of the major processes that they've just taken from the south to north redirects has only happened over the last several years. And that's really to fix the big issue in Beijing, which they're actually pumping out almost 1 million cubic meters of water out of the ground. So Beijing is actually sinking by 4 to 5 centimeters a year.
The city is sinking.
The city is sinking because of the water withdrawal.
And is this a slow and gradual demise, or is this something that can be shored up through replenishing water aquifers over the next several years?
So part of the process, this is a multi-billion dollar project to actually reroute the South to North River, was to actually bring more water up to Beijing. They're also looking at large-scale desalinization, really to stop the withdrawal in the groundwater. But if not stopped, you know, it'll continue to sink.
And it's not just rerouting water, it's also the levels of pollution. I know in the last 13th five-year plan, 2016 to 2020, they're talking about reducing total water consumption by 23% by 2020, which is an amazingly ambitious goal given the rise of the country, increase in manufacturing, rise of the middle class. How in the world are they going to reduce water consumption in an environment like this?
Yeah, it's going to be a really tough task. And one of the things that you're seeing is that not only you have population is fairly stagnant, which is in their favor, but their wealth is going up, urbanization is going up, all consumers of water, but it's also industrial and power. Yeah. So power takes up a lot of water. The industries take up quite a bit of water. But there can be some efficiencies. In China, it takes about 3 times more water to create a ton of steel than it does in the U.S. or Japan, because of inefficient processes.
And that's because this rush to catch up and deploy manufacturing, they weren't really thinking about adding the appropriate technologies. They had cheap labor.
Yeah, they had cheap labor. But also, you know, this is a bigger issue around water. Water hasn't been priced effectively. Mm. So one of the things that we're starting to see is that water is now being priced, particularly in the industrial side. So in a place like China, you'll have to pay about 7 RMB for about a cubic meter of water in the industrial side. So there, you can actually justify new technologies like desalinization, where you can actually make a return on those types of revenues.
So it's almost like a carbon tax, where you apply a certain value to something based on the degradation or the value that it holds. And then with that, you can raise money and get the right banking and lending support for it.
Well, just step back a little bit. I just think water has not been priced effectively.
Okay.
Right. So I think it's one of the few commodities in short supply that doesn't go up in price.
In other words, it just hasn't been valued because people have had this impression that it's continual and everlasting.
Yeah, and there's nobody out there putting a price on water. So I think that, you know, one of the things that desalinization has done is that it's actually put a price on water. Places like Singapore, you actually at your residential side are paying a price that actually reflects what it costs to produce water at technologies such as desal, because you can't just pump it out of the water. In a place like India, where, you know, groundwater is actually in some of the aquifers are declining by a meter per year, because the farmers are just pumping out the groundwater, you know, they're not paying for that. They're not paying for electricity and they're not paying for the water.
So it's really about water economics as a starting point to then apply the appropriate solutions for preserving, desalinating, distributing, and managing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was a great article in The Economist a couple of years ago that looked at if you had to pay the price of Atlanta tap water to actually create a hamburger, it would be $24 in water.
$24 hamburger
just for the water.
And I saw, you know, some of these numbers about how much water it takes to produce certain products. I mean, what was it? For example, a hamburger takes 460 gallons of water to make to make a cotton shirt requires 650 gallons. One egg takes 50 gallons. Explain that. I don't get that. I cook an egg. I don't use water.
No. Well, first of all, you have to feed the chicken. You actually have to grow the grain, which actually takes water to grow the livestock. Then you have to, with cows, you have to actually feed it with either grain or with grass and continue to water that and then feed the cow water. So, you know, one of the few things that, you know, that isn't being priced, except for rare exceptions, places like Australia and to some degree in the U.S. with some water trading, is that agricultural water is still mispriced.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's for most people, you look out and you see lakes and rivers and oceans, and you look at and you realize that just 2.5% of the total 336 million cubic miles of water on Earth is fresh. I mean, that's just a stunningly small percentage. And when you kind of then think about the use with agriculture and manufacturing and personal consumption, it really does start to pose quite a risk, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, we look at the forecast, by 2050, you're going to have 9 billion people on the planet. And looking at the per capita usage, you're going to need another 50 to 60% more water than we have today. And we see the supply coming down.
Peter, why isn't this, you know, in the public domain to the degree that you think it would be? I mean, cities are sinking, they're going out of water, agriculture is demanding, the cashew industry, or is it the almond or cashew industry in California?
The almond industry.
Yeah, okay. Almond industry, and it takes a huge amount of water to produce almonds, and the water tables are falling in all these markets. You know, you get little bits and bites about, you know, these water issues, but nobody seems to be throwing a light on it to say, it is potentially cataclysmic and will have major effects. And even though it might be a few decades down the way, we're talking about infrastructure projects which will take decades to build and to refine. Why is this not coming up?
Yeah, I think this is the case of, you know, human beings, right? It's not my backyard to some degree. So in California, we had 4 years of one of the worst droughts ever. And as I said, last year they had some heavy rains and everything was okay. Now they're going back to the same issue. But this is a, you know, this is a real issue about economics. And if you look at Cape Town, it could be for some civil unrest. Right. But if you look at Cape Town, housing values are going down. You know, businesses are actually having to shut down, losing revenues. And this is one of the things that's actually, while we don't read about it, there's a lot of corporations out there that are actually looking at this as risk. So you got the PepsiCos, the Coca-Colas, the Unilevers, the Nestle's that are saying, I've got real risk around water.
Right.
So I'm actually starting to, we're starting to measure that. So they're starting to measure corporations' water footprints. And they're also looking at this is a supply chain risk. There's regulatory risk and there's reputational risk around us.
These are the major beverage manufacturers. And a lot of people don't know that, but Nestle and these companies you've just mentioned produce the vast majority of drinks and things that you buy in the grocery store around the world.
Yeah. So this goes down a supply chain to not only just the water for bottled water, but this is for, you know, sugarcane. This is for, you know, foods, for snacks, for Unilever, growing vanilla beans or whatever it is, but this is a real risk to them. And they see this. So they're kind of at the front of the pack. You know, there was just an article the other day with Tyson Food that they just got fined in the US, $2 million. They have to have better water stewardship. You know, this is, they're growing kind of proteins and meats. And so it's become a real risk from, you know, a regulatory risk. But also we're now starting to see pension funds, like the Dutch pension fund has stepped in and is really starting to proactively push these companies to be better corporate citizens.
So you said two things. One is these corporations realize their viability is based on adequate and low-priced water supplies that goes into the production and the actual output of their products. So internally, they see the need to manage water and identify low-cost supply of water. But then you're also saying that because governments and others realize there's a shrinking water supply, they're making sure that these corporations are held accountable.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing that, you know, corporations like Coca-Cola, who in India built a bottling plant and then ran into issues with an aquifer drying up and had to, you know, go against some small-scale farmers, and Coca-Cola was the loser there.
Yeah.
So they have millions of dollars in investment. And I think you see the big guys taking more proactive roles. But you're seeing, you know, the Tysons of the world were just doing the minimum around regulatory side. And we're starting to see other investors, active investors and other people pushing them to actually be better corporate citizens around us. Because it is a supply chain risk, but there's also a reputational regulatory risk.
You know, between domestic agriculture and manufacturing mining, which segment is the biggest user of water?
Agriculture by far. So globally, it's about 70% of water use. If you look at a place like India or so, the developing markets, you could see it as 90% of the use. So it's a massive use.
And within agriculture, who are the culprits? Who are the ones that actually are wasting the most amount of water?
Well, I wouldn't say the culprits there. I mean, you're looking at a lot of small farmers that just don't have the financial to actually put in water savings technology. Mm. A place like India is actually subsidized by the government, so they're actually one of the early adopters in putting in drip irrigation and micro irrigation into farms. But it's almost 70% subsidized in certain states of India to put in this drip irrigation.
This is Inside Asia, and this is my interview with impact investor Peter Kennedy, head of CLSA's Clean Resources Private Equity Fund. We've been talking about water scarcity and its economic impact. Let's get back to our conversation. I've asked him about his new fund and what makes the present a good time to invest in water.
Water has been a difficult place for financial investors in the past. And I think a lot of this has to do with how it's being priced. I think what we're seeing today is that it's actually, particularly in the industrial side, it actually is being priced. Mm. We're starting to see be it priced at the residential side. And we're starting to see regulations. There's been regulations on the book for quite some time, but now we're seeing regulations enforced in places like China and places like India, where it's really being critical for that. Mm. On top of that, we also see that corporations, as we discussed, are actually taking this as a serious risk. So they're investing in this and they're willing to pay that price to make sure that they have supply chains are protected.
You know, one of the themes on our program is really the degree to which technology can make a difference and a significant difference. And, you know, as new capabilities come across with AI and with machine learning and with analytics and big data, you start to wonder, you know, which industries are going to be the greatest beneficiaries. Is the agricultural sector set up to be one of those big beneficiaries in the next 15 to 20 years?
I think both the water and the ag sector. So one of the things that you kind of point to is technology. One big thing we're seeing is sensors. And this is at the water side that we're seeing that we can real-time monitor water quality. Mm. And this is going to enable new technologies because one of the things that we're seeing both in water and ag is that technology adoption is extremely slow. And for good reasons. But part
such
of that,
as?
For good, because you're drinking water, right? Yeah, you don't want to put new technology into water that you're drinking it. And typically, historically, you've had to actually send water out to a lab and get the results back in a few days,
right.
or in some cases, 2 weeks. Yeah. So if you can real-time monitor the water, both the quality of the water going in and the quality of the water going out, you can actually be more comfortable with the technologies. So one of the things we're seeing is obviously new membranes are getting more efficient. But one of the most fascinating things we're seeing in technology side, particularly for water, is really kind of nature meets science. Mm. And this is in the microbial area. Mm. So microbes have been used in water treatment for hundreds of years in these aerobic digesters. But now we're seeing that these microbes are getting more sophisticated and they're bred so they can take heavy metals out of the water. So and you can take other components. The selectivity goes way up. So low energy, low cost, and if you could monitor them at the quality coming out, it really could be a paradigm step in how we start to treat water. So I think that's one of the more exciting parts of technology. And historically, people are worried about if it gets too cold, will the bugs live, or if it gets overwhelmed, will the bugs live. But now, if we can actually monitor that, we could be more comfortable. And we're seeing some real innovation around that area that really could game change. That'd be a game changer.
Peter, where across Asia are the hot spots? Which markets? We talked about China a little bit. You mentioned India. But are there other markets that really need to move faster than others based on kind of these trends that we pointed out, environmental change, climate change, decreasing water tables, shortage of water pollution?
Sure. I mean, you know, obviously India is one of the bigger areas. They pump out more groundwater than the China and the U.S. combined.
Did they really? And that's because of inefficiencies in agriculture.
Yes. And basically there again, the farmers have free electricity. So they're pumping out water. Yeah. And it's almost a good thing when electricity shuts down to keep the aquifers.
So there you are. You're back to the pricing point again. And this is where governments do need to play a role. They need to step in and regulate and manage and set prices.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the other hot areas, as we discussed, is Indonesia. So in parts of Indonesia, you get lots of rain, but in other parts, you're seeing real scarcity, both on Java, but you know, in Bali, which has been a real issue in Bali, is the aquifers. And the aquifers, the underground reservoirs that really are able to store water. And Bali, they've really been reduced over time because of all the hotel builds. And what that's allowed is actually seepage from the seawater coming in. So it's actually tainted a lot of the aquifer water and it needs to be treated again. So big issues, even beautiful spots like Bali.
And there's the deception, because I think the more rain than we've ever seen in Bali in recent months, and you know the rivers are flowing and the jungles are lush, and you just think, my God, it's just flush in water, but it's not. And this is something that I think is part of the problem, that there's this perception among people living there or observing or watching or using water. And then they realize, no, there's actually an underlying issue that's actually working against them. Time is working against them. And governments aren't necessarily stepping up because the perceptions are there that everything's fine.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a similar issue here in Singapore. There's lots of rain, but, you know, they were 80% reliant on Malaysia water for a long time. They've done a great job of building desal and stores, catchment areas that are now about 60, 70% self-sufficient for the water. But again, if you look out some parts of the year, you'd think there's an abundance of water, but there isn't enough catchment.
Peter, we've been educated on water. Thanks for schooling us. So appreciate your time, and we wish you great luck in raising your fund.
Oh, thanks very much. Been a real pleasure.
This is Inside Asia, and that was my conversation with impact investor Peter Kennedy, head of CLSA's Clean Resources Private Equity Fund. Thanks for listening. As Inside Asia insiders know, we end each show with an Insider Minute, during which I do my best to pull together some of the threads from the conversations we've just heard. This week, it's hard to see past the inevitability of a water crisis. If you're not convinced, let me be more specific. According to a 2016 MIT study, by 2050, that's less than 35 years from now, the trifecta of economic growth, climate change, and population demand are going to mean severe water shortages in Asia, and primarily for the region's two largest countries, China and India. By all estimates, there'll be less water then than now, and greater demand for it. By 2050, it won't be oil that leads to war, but water and all rights to it. Apocalyptic stuff, I know, but failure to address our waning water supply now will have its consequences. In technology, however, there's hope. My guest Peter Kennedy invites us to see how the private sector, armed with advanced technology, can address the problem and ensure a better future. Water management is a strategic imperative. From purification, treatment, distribution, and monitoring, it's time for us to raise water to its rightful place and apply ingenuity and engineering solutions in support of this prized resource. Failure to place a price on water has undermined the ability to rally investors' support for water projects that require capital commitment and reasonable rates of return. This isn't about what's morally right, it's about survival. And in this case, investors and technologists are prepared to combine forces and address water shortages. The degree to which governments see this as an equally compelling challenge is the real question. Politics rewards the short-sighted, and water conservation, like energy, is a long-term proposition. Do nothing, and cities and farmlands will suffer. Places like Beijing and Jakarta are literally sinking. In Jakarta alone, the illegal digging of wells have drained the deep water aquifers by more than 40%. As water reserves shrink, the city sinks. Large parts of this metropolitan area are now sitting below sea level. With each rainy season, the flooding gets worse. How will the city survive? It's a real question. Politics and funding may stand in the way, but the good news is that solutions exist and investors are circling. Establish the right set of water pricing, regulation, and distribution agreements, and the possibilities for resolving catastrophic water loss is within our grasp. To paraphrase those great environmental prophets, The Clash, and I quote, "The city you live in is sinking, and we all live by the river." This is Steve Stein, bringing you the first of four episodes on Asia's environmental challenges. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week and sign up for our newsletter by visiting us at www.insideasiapodcast.com.